Hello, everyone, and welcome to Geek History Lesson. I am Jason. Sometimes I'm lettered Inman. Sadly, our second professor, Ashley Victoria Robinson, is not here, but it's okay. I'm going to steer the ship alone because this is the podcast where we go into one character, one construct, or one team in pop culture history and tell you everything you know about them. But today, we've brought in a guest professor. We have brought in an actual professor from a school who is going to tell us secrets of their job and secrets of their industry. We've been doing some of these guys all across the year of 2021 with secrets of a comic book inker. We've done secrets of a comic book artist. And now it is time for the undersung hero of the comic book industry, the comic book letterer. So we're going to get into what does a professional comic book letterer do, and we have luckily tricked one who have worked with us before to come on to the podcast. And our special guest today, our guest is a professional comic book letterer who created Ghost Glyph Studios. They teach at the legendary Joe Kubert Institute. They have worked on and is a big fan of Red Hood and Red Hood and the Outlaws. And along with working on the Jupiter Jet series, Science, the Elements of Dark Energy, Aurora, Super Best Friend, this person is the amazing Taylor Esposito. Taylor, welcome to Geek History Lesson.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Taylor, you obviously are a professional comic book letterer. That is correct for the record?
Yes, absolutely.
For anyone that doesn't know, what exactly does a comic book letterer do?
So,
I know it's a very general question, but yeah, there are some people out there that are like, I don't really know what a letterer is.
So the basic is any kind of typographical elements that go on a page, we handle. So obviously your word balloons, your caption boxes, your thought balloons, sound effects, depending on who the artist is, if they drew stuff in themselves, it would be billboards, cell phones, all that kind of stuff. But anything with like, anything you'd be actually reading, it's our domain.
Now, let me ask you, you mentioned specifically like billboards and signs. So I would love to just hear a ballpark average here. How many artists actually throw in all the lettering for billboards and signs, and how many artists don't? Like, what would you say? Is it 50-50 or?
You know, it's hard to say because as much as I mentioned that, because I know I've seen it done before, I've done a couple before, it doesn't come up as often as you think, at least with my books. I guess because I'm not working on, you know, Nightwing or Spider-Man where they're hanging up on rooftops all the time. One of my characters are on the ground. But I'd say maybe about half, 50-50.
That is a fair point that modern comic books are on the ground. So we don't
we're never rooftops anymore. Like they used to be the fun part of it, you know?
Well, I mean, we know if listeners have seen, you know, season two or season one of Daredevil's on Netflix, there is that scene where he goes to the rooftops, and when you see a real person trying to jump over those rooftops, you're like, oh yeah, this is not practical unless you're somebody like Spider-Man or you could fly.
Oh yeah, no, like I look at those gaps and what are they, maybe 10 feet? And
oh
like,
yeah.
Nope, I can't make that jump.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Taylor, what would you describe as good comic book lettering? Like, what is your definition for that term?
Oh, that's such a loaded question. It's hard for me to put it into words, you know. Ironic that I'm a letterer.
I mean, yeah, come on, man. Like
it's easier to say what doesn't make good lettering, you know, and because everyone has their style too. Like what I consider, you know, good for me or my standard isn't necessarily what the next person would. But there are some standards we go for, you know. We do try to stay off of the main figures. In an ideal world where, you know, the artists are doing things that help us and not hinder us, we would have the top third of every panel. Our speakers would be in the correct order. You know, like if the first person is speaking, they're on the left and then so on. The text of the balloon would be kind of, you know, stacked in almost like a diamond shape, which allows for a more perfectly round balloon around the text. Because like I say, it's easier to describe bad lettering. So bad lettering, a lot of times you have all this extra negative space in your balloons and it, like, you may not know it. You may look at like, it's a comic, it's fine. But at the back of your mind, you'd be like, something's off here and I'm not sure what it is.
Interesting. I've never heard the diamond theory. The text, if you're reading a good comic word balloon, the text should form a diamond. So it should be smaller at the top and bigger at the bottom.
Yeah, but just like a circle, you know, it's the top and bottom are narrower and the middle part's wider. Now, the exception for this, obviously, is a butted balloon. You could do half the size. So it's kind of just like an upside down pyramid or something.
We're going to get even more technical here. What do you mean by a butted balloon? Because I know what a linked balloon is. And listeners, this is something that you don't learn until you actually make comic books. A linked balloon is like when you see a character saying two word balloons in a row and there's like a little tail between the two. But what is a butted balloon?
So, like I said, you know how we try to have the top third of the panel. Whenever you see balloons, panels like that, usually those balloons are pushed to the top. So the top of the panel acts as one of the borders of the balloon. So anything that's pushed up against the top is butted to the edge.
Oh, okay. So it's where the word balloon like forms that like flat panel edge.
Exactly.
Interesting. Okay. Well, what do you have any more determinations or any more tips or tricks of like what do you see in bad lettering that really just like blows your top?
So the first thing is improper use of the serifed I. So when you're reading a comic, right, the pronoun I or I am, I'm, whatever, has these two little bars at the top and bottom. That's so you know for sure, okay, that's I. In the middle of a word, you know, like king, for example, you wouldn't put that because it would add more negative space to either side of the slash. Mm-hmm. And it would also just take up more space in general. Because that's the other thing too. A lot of lettering is about space saving. And you know, this is going to take us slightly off topic, so I get into a different thing.
Oh, we're all about tangents on this podcast. It's all good.
No, we don't want tangents. That's bad lettering.
Oh, no, there we go.
I was saying though, lowercase or mixed case lettering rather, you know, like the traditional way we read and write, like from books or on paper. You know, that has ascenders and descenders. Ascenders being anything, and I'm getting so technical. All right. Let's pretend we're looking at the old lined paper in school. Remember, like the blue lines?
Yeah, we have our three holes on the side. We have the blue lines. We have the red, like, margin line on the left.
Yeah, and then it's like a solid line, a middle dashed line, and another solid line, right? Mm-hmm. So the baseline is obviously the line where everything starts, right? Then you have the X height, which is that dotted line in the middle. So that's the X height of a letter. And then you have ascenders and descenders. Ascenders rising above that dotted line and descenders dropping below the baseline. Traditionally, comic book lettering, you know, when it was done by hand and it was done on newsprint, to save effort on the letterer's hand, things were done uppercase because it's a lot more just, you know, up and down movement, not so much extra picking up the pen and moving things around to make like the dots on the I's and the swoosh on the J, all this stuff. But also it prevented bleed, which, you know, as we know, you put ink down, it starts bleeding across the page. These were done to keep things legible. It's not as big a factor anymore because we have much more advanced technology with printing and ink and all this stuff. But there's still the issue of space. Adding descenders is going to add more space to the lettering because you want to make sure you don't hit the ascenders on the next line. So, you know, when someone tells you, it's easier to read mixed case lettering, it's not necessarily true. I mean, it's easier for people who have reading disabilities, things like that, absolutely, but it doesn't make the job any easier and it doesn't make it easier on the general population, if I can say, you know, like those of us who are used to reading comics a certain way, it is a little bit, oh, that's a little different. And there are ways to get around that. Like, you know, you have font designers who are designing fonts with small descenders to not get, you know, touch the next line. But it still does need to be factored in.
I feel like you just explained to us how a nuclear missile works. I feel like you comic books are this giant missile And I feel like listening to you just now, you took out your drill, you unscrewed the drills and you opened it up. And I just saw the plutonium core and my mind was melted.
This is funny because I've had this conversation with Aubrey when we talk about all of our books together.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll say, can we do this?
Aubrey Citizen, the writer.
Aubrey Citizen, yes. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about he'll ask me, can we do this? Can we do that? And I'll say, so I have to get into my theory of lettering in a second and start going off why I do certain things and don't do certain things. And I just feel like I just overly explained everything. He's like, no, man, that's great. I love hearing what you got to say. It's clear that you're not just throwing stuff down here. You're putting thought into this. And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, you have to put thought into this. Otherwise, what is the difference between me doing it and, getting a program to do it for you?
Well, listeners, that and Taylor, this will tell you why Aubrey Citizen is a much better writer than I am, because he puts thought into this and he's always going to Taylor. He does the excellent Beef Bros. And what's his new Dark Horse book that you work on, Taylor?
So let's see. The Worst Dudes is halfway done.
The Worst Dudes.
Savage Hearts just got started. I think we're in issue 2 now. And we just announced the sequel to No One Left to Fight.
Well, see, there you go. See, this is why Aubrey is so much better writer. So he's talking to Taylor and he's reaching out and he's been like, how can we push lettering? And I'm just like, Taylor will handle it. I trust him. I'm always like, he'll do it.
He does that too. You should see his scripts to me. Every time he wants me to do something, he just says Taylor magic. He's like, all right, I get to do whatever I want here.
Yeah, I'm always like, Taylor, can we do this? Or Taylor, can we do,
yeah,
anyways.
Sure.
I want to go into a little bit of going to old school, because you brought this up about digital during versus physical.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to say some stuff, Taylor, and as, as a professor at the Joe Kubert Institute, please correct me at any point if I'm wrong. Now, back in the day, you were talking about bleeding, all kinds of things like this. Back in the day, comic book lettering was they would have to cut out with something I assume that is like an X-Acto knife, mm-hmm. the shape of paper or the comic book board of the word balloon. And then they would put that on top of the actual artwork of the comic. And that is where the letterer would actually ink the words of the comic book. Correct.
That was one method. Actually, that's not the only way. So Originally, way back in the day, before they had even that kind of stuff, the way it would work, penciler would pencil, pages would go to letterer. Actually, letterer would rule all of the panel borders and ink them and put the lettering down. Then it would go to the inker. They would ink everything around that. And then it would go to color to get the color dyes put on. That was how it used to be done. And this is all just my reading. So if I got something wrong, I'm sorry. I'm just going back on what I remember.
Hey, but you're a professor of the Kubert Institute, so you're right. They're wrong. Just go.
Well, I'm right, except for my colleagues who have been doing this longer. I defer to them every time.
All right.
I'm not afraid to admit when I don't know something. So then the method you were talking about, that came about a little later when they would have, they would do vellum overlays. They would ink, they would letter on these overlays. And then, mm-hmm. Someone would have to cut them out, color the back with a white color so it wouldn't show through,
mm-hmm.
and then stick that on. So that was done, I think, probably 80s and 90s. They would do it that way. So you would see it. They would actually have paste ups. If you look at artwork from that era, sometimes you see the glue is discoloring and stuff.
Yeah, I can. So I have a page from Young Justice, from the original Young Justice.
Yeah, I think around that time they were definitely doing that.
Yeah, and you can see all the word. And it's really cool because it's the only page of original art I have that actually has the word balloons on it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of see that, yeah, it's a different type of paper. It is a different color than the regular page. But I also love it because you can actually read it.
Oh, yeah, that's one of the best parts of having an original art with lettering on the boards. Unfortunately, it's just not feasible in today's market. It would cost too much and it would take too long. So,
well, it's also the same thing. Yeah. It's same with many artists now are all digital and they don't have original art pages because it's just, they're able to be so much faster digitally, which I assume letterers are able to be faster as well. I want to talk about this. Before we get out of the old school argument of letterers, mm-hmm. is there a classic letterer? Let's say pre 1990.
Okay.
That we all should know that a lot of people don't give credit to? Is there somebody that sticks out to you in your head that you're like, this guy or this lady?
I mean, you could say so many people. We could start with Gaspar. So September 1st is Letter Appreciation Day.
Mm-hmm.
And we picked that day because that was Gaspar's birthday.
Okay.
And for people who don't know, Gaspar was a letter, I think, going back to the Golden Age, to be honest. He's worked on pretty much everything. He used to do the Marvel page ones. Like, Marvel would have a letter on the book, but page one would be his, and he would do all the books.
And you're talking about, I just want to confirm, you're talking about Gaspar Saladino?
Saladino, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Everyone called him Gaspar. That was mm-hmm. it. So he, for a while, uncredited, unfortunately, but he was the page one guy. So every time you'd open up a book and it's like that beautiful splash, you know, in the Marvel style mm-hmm. with the title and like all these crazy word balloons, that was Gaspar. And then, you know, it would be like, for the sake of argument, I don't know if they actually worked together, but Artie Simic or Sam Rosen or, Tom Warzykowski would be the interior letterer, you know? So he's like definitely one of the top guys. Obviously, you can't talk about this stuff without talking about Todd Klein, who is still working to this day.
Yes, yes.
Trying to think.
Real quick before you come up with the rest of your list, just for our listeners, I want to point out that if you have not Googled Gaspar Saladino, famous comic book letterer, please do it. Because there's two big things that everybody probably knows him for and we don't realize is that one, he designed the logo for Swamp Thing, that classic yes. like green logo that's kind of dripping and everybody knows that logo. I think the TV show even used that logo. And then he also lettered Grant Morrison and Dave McKean's Arkham Asylum, where yes. it like has all the weird black word balloons. And
yep, that was him.
It was like one of the first times that the lettering had been kind of change from normal traditional comic book lettering. So that is like two things in his giant career.
Yeah, because I think that was 88 and Sandman didn't get started till
like 91, I think. 91, 92.
Yeah.
Okay, so Taylor, we're going to move on from the classics. Gaspar Saladino, Todd Klein is also another legend. I want to ask you, because you are a lettering legend, how do you decide what font complements what story?
So what I do, and you know, this is just me, I will take a script and the art, and I'll kind of flip through both of them, get a feel for the story, an idea of what's going on. And then my criteria is, one, what pairs with the art, you know? I'll see what kind of complements the style of the drawings. Like, if it's a bit more cartoony, I'll go with something a little bit more bouncy. If it's like, okay, this looks like Andy Kubert drew it, yeah, I'm going to go with like something really superhero looking.
Mm-hmm.
If it's like, you know, really offbeat and weird, I'll try to find like the weirdest looking font that's still legible. So that's the one side. And the other thing is like tone of story, you know, because sometimes it's nice to play against the type too. So like, maybe it is really cartoony, but it's a really dark book, you know, like we're going for like super subversive or whatever. Yeah, then I'll go with like something that looks really serious against a cartoony thing. And, you know, it's up to me to make it work. These are just tools like anything else. Anybody can pick up a tool and use it, but how many people can use it well? I'm not saying that I do it well. I'll let you say it, but I won't say it because I can't talk about myself like that. But, you know, it's a matter of, you know, the tools one side and the talent and the experience is the other. That's the thing too. Like, and I've said this to my students multiple times. I picked up the stuff I first worked on when I first started lettering, and I look at them like, this is atrocious. What was I doing? I look at stuff from a year ago and I can see all the flaws. And I mean, that's the sign of any creator. You'll always see everything that's wrong. And as you get better and get removed from those things, you see them worse. You know, like every creator is notoriously hard on themselves. If you're not, I think you're just egotistical and, you know, whatever.
Yeah. That's a fair point. Now, I want to ask you, what has been exciting you? What has been inspiring you in modern contemporary lettering? Like, is there anything out there that people are doing that you're like, oh, wow, that's pretty great, or that's pretty awesome? Have there been any game changers recently?
Well, my friend Tom Napolitano is doing such crazy things right now. I look at it and I'm like, oh, I hate you so much, but you're so good.
Now what has he been doing? Like, in what book specifically?
I've just seen bits and pieces here and there. I know he was working on the Metal books for a while.
The DC Comics Metal books.
The DC Comics mm-hmm. Metal. What else was he working on recently? I can't remember, but he did this one sound effect of like the sword hitting the ground, and it was what's the word I'm looking for?
He's right. Currently, I'm finding that if you go to his Twitter, he is at TEN Napolitano.
Napolitano.
Yes. He's been working on a lot of the Batman books recently. Yeah. What he's been posting.
But there's one he did where the sound effect is like in perspective with the sword, and it's part of the shadow. And it was just, I just looked at him like I was in awe. My mouth was open, and I was like, damn, he's so good. Excuse me, my language there, but how is he this good? I can't believe it.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, this is something it might be interesting to get a letterer's perspective on this. What do you feel about artists drawing the sound effects?
So I'm okay with that. Okay. I'm totally okay with it. But my thing is, if you're going to do it across the board. Because like,
be consistent, you know, with it.
Yeah, because as good as I am, you know, as far as my job, like, I can't do what you do by hand, and I don't want to have to try to copy it.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's obvious and it doesn't work. And, you know, I'm always out servicing the story. Whatever services the story is better, you know. And if the artist wants to do their sound effects like Jeb does on The Worst Dudes. Wait, is it Jeb on The Worst Dudes?
I don't know.
I don't remember right now. I'm so out of it.
It's all good. It's all good. Everybody, we're widely forgiven because there are so many names and so many things.
I work on so much, I lose track of everything. Tony Gregory, that's it. I'm sorry. Jeb is on Savage Heart.
Tony Gregory is the artist of The Worst Dudes of Dark.
Yes. Tony's been doing his own sound effects. And they're beautiful. They totally fit the world of the book. Absolutely. And I wouldn't dream of doing the sound effects on my own. But like, as I said, like I dread the day he accidentally forgets one. Cause like, no, dude, you have to do it. Cause it just works. You know what I mean?
Interesting. It's just an interesting thought to think about, to be like, okay, so, you know, it would be such an impossible task sometimes for have you as the letterer to have to match the artistic style of that artist. But I have a question for you, Taylor, because I know you also do a little bit of designing, you do a little bit of photoshopping. So I'm going to ask you this random question. If I were to ask you to draw me a doodle of something, how good are you? Are you a good doodler?
I'm awful. Okay. I mean, I went to art school, but yeah. I really specialized in design and typography, which is why I was drawn to lettering, as it were.
Well, I don't know. You might be better than I think, because something that I have discovered is working in the comic book industry is that everybody across the board, most writers, letterers, colorists, editors, can kind of almost doodle, or they can kind of draw, because I think we all got into comic books. The art is what drew us in originally, you know, mm-hmm. I think is what pulled us in, and the writing kept us there and all this stuff like that. But I think like everybody, like you all kind of find like what position you settle at, or what you're like, oh, I enjoy doing this, I'm really good at this. But then I don't know. I think you might be able to draw some better than stick figures, I would imagine.
Don't get me wrong. I used to draw in college, but you know, those are muscles I haven't flexed in a long time. I mean, I've been doing this now 10 years, pretty much nonstop. And I don't even mean that as an exaggeration. I think it's been pretty much nonstop. And, you know, like the more you work one muscle, you lose another. And that's what it is. I just haven't had a chance to just sit down and draw for fun. I mean, I have ideas and I can do stuff, but, you know, I wouldn't call myself a good quality by any chance. I can hold my own. I can do rough storyboards for my class if I have to.
There you go. So I want to talk about what were some favorite projects you've worked on. And if you want, let's start off where, what was your first lettering job?
Oh, my first job.
Did I stump you?
Kickstarter.
It was a Kickstarter. Okay. And why did you say yes to this? Like, why were you like, this is the one?
Oh, because I needed work.
That's a fair answer.
It was like a month removed from getting laid off.
Yeah, that's a very fair answer.
It was one of those things like I needed experience. This team needed a letter, and it was just kind of like, hey, can I work with you guys to learn? And, you know, obviously you'll get my work. And, you know, I think it was of an acceptable quality for my first job, you know. On the strength of that and one other job I had done and my enthusiasm was why I got hired at DC in the first place.
Yes. And you worked at DC for several years, I believe, right?
I was there for about 2.5 years, I think.
See, that's several, everybody, right?
Yeah, because I was there until they moved.
Mm-hmm. So, to Los Angeles, yes.
To Los Angeles, yeah. They were in New York and they moved out to Burbank. And I didn't want to go out to Burbank. So I was there October of 2012 to December of 2014. And Ghost opened in 2015.
All right, now let's take the listeners into behind the doors of DC Comics. In one month, how many books would you letter in 30 days at DC?
I think my peak was 11.
Okay. Okay. And just in case anybody doesn't know, let's just say a 22-page comic book. Mm-hmm. What's the fastest? And then like, what is the average time it would take you to letter a 22-page comic book?
Let's say anywhere between 5 and 8 hours, depending on how wordy it is.
Okay, so you could do it in a day.
Yeah.
Yeah, depending on how wordy it is. I love that. That is also something, yeah, it just depends on how wordy that writer is.
I mean, look, I lettered a Batman book in 5 minutes once.
Wow.
It was silent.
Yes.
But I lettered it.
Yeah, that's true. Well, that's the other advantage that a lot of people don't realize is that even if there are no letters on the page, or maybe even just one sound effect, you still get paid for that page. So
I get full rate every time.
Right. And that's the way it should be.
Well, the alternative is every time there's like a page with like 39 balloons on it, I'm still getting my page rate. So it just evens out.
I once had a writer tell me, a comic book writer once tell me where that there were one time they were doing a story and they were like, I'm going to challenge myself. And I'm going to do a silent issue. I'm just going to see if I can do it. And so they wrote it, they did it, and they threw it out there. And I remember asking them, saying, well, how did you think it went? And the writer's response was, well, I don't think anybody think I wrote it. I think they think the artist did everything because there's no words on the page.
I mean, that's the deceptive part of comics. I mean, I'm not saying that an artist couldn't do that. Absolutely could.
Yes.
Artists are the most important part of our industry.
Of course.
But, you know, everything you're not seeing is on the page. You know, like you should see the scripts. Like, I mean, you obviously, you know, because you write them. But panel descriptions, plot points, all this stuff is in there, you know, and the stuff that the artist has to be aware of. And if you're doing the team method, you know, if you're not just a cartoonist who writes and draws their own stuff, you know, sometimes for the artist, it's nice to have that person who's just like, okay, here's point A to point B. Here's the things we have to do. Go nuts. Because then they know, all right, as long as I have this stuff in there, I got this story under control, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's also like a tough debate from the writer side for myself, like how much of that do you give and how much do you not, you know? And it's always that like, okay. Do I think this artist can handle it? Do I think this letter, like for, you know, and this is why I love working with you, Taylor. And it's the reason why, you know, you've lettered all our books and stuff like that is because I know I can throw anything at you and you can handle it. Like you can take it and you will improve it and you will make it better, which is to me, the whole point of collaboration.
I mean, that's the hope, you know, like I try to do that. I hope I'm doing that. But, you know, if something, like I said, we've talked about this, if something's not feasible or I don't think I can do it, we always talk about it and we try to find a solution. You know, I don't think it's come up on our stuff per se, but like, let's say we wanted to get something on the page. I'm like, listen, the program won't let me do this. I can design the thing. And if we throw it back to the artist, maybe he can get it in there and like, you know, finagle it in. But, I'm all about finding solutions. One reason I got into comics and lettering is because I like working on a team. I like problem solving together.
Mm-hmm.
And with lettering, it's almost always that. You know,
so Taylor, I want to ask you about a little bit about your time at DC Comics. Were there any besides Red Hood? Were there any favorite projects that you had while you worked there?
So I got to work on Constantine for a good long while. I think I came on like issue 5 or 7, something like that. And I stuck with the book, I think, till I left, which was great. I did a lot of fill-in while I was there. I was the last hire, and everything had kind of been, this is, you know, this was the New 52 era. I think we're about a year in when I came in. So everything was pretty much assigned. So I was either getting new projects here or there, or inheriting existing projects, or because I was so fast, this book is in and the guy's busy. We got to get at the door, take it. And that was the other nice thing too, because we all worked closely together in the lettering department. There were 4 of us. I learned from everybody, and we kind of all were able to mimic each other. Mm-hmm. So, you know, obviously it was me lettering the book, and you can see my influence on it, but
and was
it
that
still looked cohesive, you know?
Okay. And I was going to say, at DC Comics, was that an important thing that was brought up where they were like, they wanted the line in terms of lettering to look cohesive and to look similar?
At the time, yeah. I remember when I came in, the lettering supervisor was like, you know, we were making an effort. It's a new universe. Let's keep things like, let's use the lettering as an anchor. You know, even if the artist is changing, you know, you're reading Batman because it looks like a Batman book, and you know, you're reading Superman because it looks like a Superman book, that kind of stuff. I do think that helps. I grew up, you know, back when an artist was on a book for like 10 years.
Yeah, the legend so like, runs, yes.
I mean, you know, I remember looking at Robin, and Robin looked the same for how many issues? Like,
at least back when, 50? Yeah, when you're talking about when like Tom Grummett and Chuck Dixon were on the book for like...
Yeah, like
it was
Tom, like 50, Tom Grummett's Robin was Robin issues, to me.
Yeah, it's the same as a Scott McDaniel's Nightwing. Like he
exactly, yeah. Like and that, like, you picked up a Nightwing book, you knew it looked like Scott McDaniel's mm-hmm. Nightwing. Or Arrow for a long time. Green Arrow was like that too.
Yeah. Or Dan Jurgens Superman.
Oh, absolutely. Dan Jurgens. I grew up, I think it was 8 years old when the Death of Superman happened. I remember Dan's Superman very vividly. Or actually Steel for me is...
with John Bogg, yes.
John Bogg, yeah. Like that's Steel. Like I can't picture anybody else drawing him.
I'm the same.
But yeah, that's how we grew up. So like, you know, if a writer changed, I wouldn't notice, but when the art changed, I definitely noticed. And obviously we can't do it anymore. The modern, comic landscape, books are longer. Books come out faster sometimes, like Spider-Man comes out, what, like 18 times a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a million of them.
It's impossible to keep one person in the book, especially because also the level of detail we expect out of comics has changed, you know, like, you know, even as far as the 90s, like you could still kind of rough in some things as long as your main figures looked good. I think the expectation has changed now where everything has to be so draftsman-y. Again, nothing wrong with it, but I think it takes a toll on the artist, and it's just too hard to keep up.
Can I ask you a question? Let's go into the DC vault a little bit more. And if you don't remember, that's totally fine. But I'm very curious. You said you were at the time of the DC New 52, which is that new, they rebooted all their books back to one, and they were trying to, you know, first time digital, same date as digital and physical in the stores for DC Comics. What was the font of the New 52 or that you used? Do you remember what it was? Can you say? Is that a trade secret? I don't know.
I don't think it's a trade secret.
Okay.
I know Batman books were Comic Crafts, yada, yada, yada.
Okay.
I think Superman books were Comic Crafts, Adam Kubert.
All right. I'm looking at the yada, yada upper font. I just Googled it as Taylor was talking about it. I mean, yeah, it just looks like a very standard... kind of squarish.
It's a little square. Font. Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually do like yada, yada, yada as like a go-to. It's very clean, very simple.
According to this website, it was originally created for the X-Men Age of Apocalypse crossover. Oh, interesting.
That makes sense.
All right. That's really good. And that was a smart move on them back in the day that when they, you know, when the Age of Apocalypse event interrupted the X-Men books, that they were like, let's change the font to clearly show or even subconsciously show the reader that things have changed.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you, this is a little bit off topic, but I think it'll work out. Taylor, do you like or hate the statement that I've heard from many professionals that good comic book lettering is when you don't notice the lettering. What do you think about that statement? Do you think it's true, or do you think you're like, I don't buy that?
It's true-ish. Like, yes, you shouldn't be glaringly aware of it, I think. But there are times when you can appreciate it, you know? I think attitudes have also changed, because I think that statement used to be made when there wasn't like as big an interest in lettering, you know, like it was just one of those things. Like, it's a hand lettering, staff job, whatever. I think because of the advent of social media, because more of us are out there who are passionate about it, I think it's gotten more attention. So I don't think that's true anymore. And I think also digital has caught up to a point where it will never look like hand lettering, but I think we can do a lot more with it now. You know, funny enough, I was listening to another letterer talk about something back in the days when lettering shifted from digital hand to digital. They said they used to type it out on the computer, print it out, cut it out, and paste it up, just like the paste ups you were talking about. And it's like, we've come a long way, because now that's just redundancy. You know, it's like extra.
Yes.
But at the time, it had to be done like that.
That would have changed the game in the 90s or late 90s, early 2000s when that happened. Like, that would have sped up so many letters, and it would have been perfectly spaced and the right size.
I mean, unfortunately, one of the side effects was it did push a lot of the older letterers out. You know, it's one of those things, evolve or die, not die, but you know what I mean? Like, move on. And I think a lot of them didn't want to or couldn't evolve in that sense. You know, like, at the time too, you have to remember, these computers were really expensive. Like, now it's fairly reasonable to buy a new computer out of nowhere. But back then, I think that would have cost, it's probably the same cost as today, but you know, inflation, it's nothing today compared to back then.
Taylor.
But yeah, so some guys like Todd and Tom Warzykowski definitely got with the new system, and some guys just, they were done.
Well, speaking of new systems, you eventually left DC. You decided to not make the move to the West Coast with DC Comics, and that led you to a point in your career where you founded Ghost Glyph Studios, which is your lettering house. Is it proper to call it lettering house or lettering company? What would you prefer it called? You are the CEO.
Either or.
Let's call it a lettering house. You're lettering house. What prompted you to do so, besides the fact that you were like, I need work, but like, what made you decide that this was the time to, for myself, become an independent letterer, to sort of like be the gunslinger out there by yourself?
So one thing was, and I don't know, I love my time at DC. It was probably the best office job I ever had. One of my favorite jobs.
Well, I'll scratch off the next question. How much did you hate DC? Got it.
No, I loved it there. but I also knew I couldn't go back to an office job. Like, I'm not built for it. I don't like having to do work for the sake of just, you know, like busy work, that kind of stuff. Also, just in general, you know, DC aside, my experience with office jobs is always like, oh, we need you to do this now. It's like, well, I'm not qualified to do that. It's not part of my job description. I wanted to get that out of my hands. Like, I don't want to be involved in that anymore. And the other thing was honestly just commute. I was tired of commuting.
Yeah, because you were going from New Jersey-ish area, right, into, because all DC offices, anybody doesn't know, they were basically across from the Ed Sullivan Theater on Broadway.
Yeah, but when I was there, it was still Letterman. So yeah, back when.
Yeah. Letterman. I remember I got to see those offices once, like right in the last 2 weeks before everybody had already moved to Los Angeles, but the offices were still there. Mad Magazine was still there.
Yeah, Mad stayed for like another year, I think.
They did, actually. They did. But like, it was like basically an empty hallway, and I got to see very cool desk, the Daily Planet desk as you walked in. Which
It was that thing awesome.
It was really, really cool.
And that was when I was there, it was only the three floors. It used to be five. So it used to be like the Batman floor, the Superman floor, like a general DC floor, I think, the Mad floor, and I think it was a Vertigo floor at one point.
So, as I've mentioned several times, we know you're a big Jason Todd Red Hood fan. what was it like for you when you were finally offered to letter Red Hood and the Outlaws, to basically get to letter your favorite character?
Actually, I got it because it was late.
And, oh, so the book was running behind, so it worked.
The book was running behind, and they just threw it at me. And then it was like, well, I mean, I kind of like Jason. At the time, I was still a big Dick Grayson fan. It's interesting. When I was reading comics, it was the infamous Jason with a snot-nosed little punk. I think that's exactly what Denny O'Neil said. And yeah, nobody liked him.
He was stealing tires off the Batmobile. I mean, little punk is probably the right correct term.
And this is probably about 5 years removed from the big Hush reveal, right? Because Hush was like 2005 or so.
Yeah, somewhere around that time. 2004, I believe.
So, yeah, somewhere around this. So maybe it was 7 years, let's say. So he was just starting to get really cool. I think they did the Grant Morrison thing where he had like the pill helmet in the white costume, all that good stuff. And then let's see, so I end up on the book and I'm like, yeah, you know what? Pretty cool. I like him. And then as getting into it, I'm like, actually, Jason's really cool. Like, I'm glad I got this book. So he ended up becoming my favorite Robin that way. And now I can appreciate the older stories a little bit more, you know. I'm also a hothead, so it just makes perfect sense. So.
Yes, I mean, that's the thing I'm always saying. I'm always worried that Taylor's emails are going to be all caps and he's just going to be
never.
No. All right. So another part of a letterer's job sometimes is logo design. It is generally the thing that catches people's attentions on comic book covers. I mean, they're used in movies. We talked about the Swamp Thing. Comic book logo is basically used in the television show. For yourself, is logo design just another part of lettering, or do you see it as like a completely different art form?
I mean, it is a different art form because that's more like traditional graphic design, you know. It's about letter forms rather than, I mean, legibility is there too, but like the nice part about logos is you can look at letters on a purely like design level, you know. They don't necessarily have to be the thing they are. They're just beautiful shapes to look at as well. So I would say they're related animals, not necessarily different.
Do you have a preference? Do you like pure lettering over logo design? Do you like logo design over pure lettering?
I do, because I prefer storytelling.
Oh, so you prefer just pure lettering?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I mean, I get the itch every so often to do logos. Right now I'm burnt out on it. It's just, they take up a lot of the mental energy.
All right, everybody. So don't send any logo design requests to Taylor.
Yeah, I'm not doing logos right now. they do take up a lot of energy, and it takes away from lettering, which, like I said, I do enjoy more. I just like storytelling more. Mm-hmm. It's not to say I won't do it again. I do have fun with it, but I mean, you know, not to get too into it, but like it also just doesn't pay as well as it should. You know, logo design in any other industry is big bucks.
I think you could say that about, yeah, graphic design overall, but graphic design in comic books is probably lower paying than it should be.
Yeah. And that's the thing, like with lettering, I can make it work because I'm fairly fast and I like what I do, and you know, it works out. Mm-hmm. With logos, it just, you know, you put in enough time and you're just like, I would rather be doing the thing that's more fun, you know?
Which is the storytelling of it all.
Yeah.
Now, what to you makes a great comic book logo? Like, what are the essential elements?
Again, I'm going to go back. I'm old school, and I just love those heavy lines. You know, you look at something like, what's it called? Like the Spider-Man logo. I think they're still using that one right now. The Amazing Spider-Man with the web on it.
Oh, yes.
You look at the classic Superman, which, I mean, has been updated, but it's essentially the same basic one.
And I don't even know when that logo first popped up. The 80s? The late 70s, maybe?
The redesign on the Superman logo?
Where it's like the big S, and it's like, yeah, the rest of the word is pushing away from camera.
I think the update might have even come like in the 60s.
I'm going to try to see if I can figure this out, because yes, we all know what the Superman logo is, or the Superman, like the word Superman.
Yeah,
is.
Superman in that telescopic.
It is basically not changed for so long.
You can see some stuff like the S from the 40s compared to now is a little bit more chunky. Like there's not quite as smooth.
Mm-hmm.
I think the U has also got like a joint in it rather than being perfectly rounded. I think actually Todd Klein might have covered it in his blog.
So it kind of, I have found some information here. So the first sort of version of this appeared on the very first issue of Superman in 1939.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have like slightly adjusted it. The modern one popped up in 1983. And that is the one that we see
The one we have today. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is like has not changed since 1983. Yeah,
why would you change something that works?
Yeah. It's pretty stellar. It's interesting because, you know, it's so interesting, especially when you're looking at DC and since your time at DC, that Superman has been able to maintain this logo since 1983. And I kind of feel like Batman changes every 2 years, no matter what.
It's hard. You know, don't get me wrong,
And there have been some Batman logos that I thought like, there it is. Don't change it.
Yeah, like I grew up with that Batman logo, the one with the blocky letters that look like the Burton logo,
mm-hmm.
but with the bat with his face on it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's like his cape is forming the background.
Yeah. Like that's one of my favorites. But I also loved, I think it was about the Marshall Rogers era when it's like his head and the cape and it's engulfing the Detective Comics
mm-hmm.
Name. I mean, I love a lot of those Batman logos, even like the simpler 60s ones and just like the bubble letters. They still work for me. I don't have them up right now, but in my office, I had a bunch of classic comics and like I look at the old Teen Titans logo, like the 60s one with the angle on it and stuff.
I was a big fan of the sort of Batman Hush update where they like sort of where
the
like
cape, yeah.
they made the words like kind of bulky, kind of some would say fat. And mm-hmm. but they still had like hard pointy edges to them, and then the background was sort of an update of the Batman with his face and the cape, which I thought mm-hmm.
It was a good logo. Yeah, I
that was
that
a
one.
Really good logo, and that's the logo that I kind of was like, oh, that there it is right there, that mm-hmm. should be the Batman logo like now, because even if you were to drop the background, I think it still
reads as Batman. Yeah.
It still feels like Batman, and I would say that some of the modern redesigns have gotten a little crazy, I think, and have made it very
different. I mean, I do like the one that's on Detective right now, the one that Kenny Lopez designed for Detective Comics.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a great logo.
It's the bat. It says Batman on the top part of the bat and Detective Comics in the bottom. That one's great. I love that one.
So I want to talk to you about what brought you finally, well, like turn this all around, because we said that you are a professor, you know, we are the Mind University here, is what we like to call this podcast. What brought you to start teaching at the Joe Kubert School? And could you explain like what the Joe Kubert School is? Because we've been talking about it, like everybody knows what this is. Would you explain like what is the Joe Kubert School, the Joe Kubert Institute, and what led you to teach there?
So the Joe Kubert School is a school in Dover, New Jersey. It's been there since 74.
Mm-hmm.
Founded by Joe Kubert. You know, he saw there was like a want for people to learn, but there was no place to do it. So he decided to do it there. And, you know, I believe the first graduating class was Tom Mandrake and Jan Duresma. So yeah, like big deals. But they, you know, they teach you how to lay out pages, draw the books, lettering, coloring, basically to make you a fully rounded comic artist. So when you get out there, you can just start getting work. And so, unfortunately, Joe passed away. What was it now?
It was in
7 years.
I was going to say like 5 or 6 years ago. Yeah.
Something like that. So he passed away and I think Adam and Andy were still running it. And my editor on Red Hood, Anthony Marquez, was a graduate of the school. He had heard they were looking to get, you know, they have their work they want to do. That stuff, so they don't really want to handle it anymore. So they sold it to him, and he was coming in, and he's like, you know, he just calls me out of the blue, and he's like, "Do you want to teach?" Like, you know, I've always thought about it, but I don't know if I'm qualified. Like, well, I'm taking over, and I would like you to be the lettering instructor. I'm like, oh, for you, anything. So That's basically what brought me to teaching.
And then everybody, there was a secret part of Taylor's contract that said, okay, you can only bring up a Red Hood once a day. We just can't. The class cannot be best Red Hood lettering, Taylor. If you go follow everybody, Taylor, on social media, you'll understand these jokes. So Taylor, let's end this off with, just in case anybody out there is thinking about, hey, comic book lettering, this sounds like exactly what I want to do. This is my destiny. This is where I want to go. Do you have any tips or tricks for anybody that is thinking about getting into comic book lettering?
So the simplest thing I can tell you is look for resources. There are two books out there right now, Comic Book Lettering, The Comic Craft Way, and The DC Guide to Coloring and Lettering. These are the books I use to learn how to do this. And I think with just that, you could at least learn to do your own stuff for sure. There's going to be a third book coming out this year. Actually, I got the privilege of reading it early. Nate Picos from Blindbot is doing his own book. And he asked me to like check it over because of my position at the Hebert School. And I got to read it, and it's phenomenal. It's probably the most comprehensive. It's also up to date, which is the problem with those other two books. I think they're about 20 years old now.
What was the name of that book, Taylor?
Nate's book is, let me just look that up because I...
Yeah, let's give it a plug, because everybody, we can put on our recommended reading.
So I found the book. It's The Essential Guide to Comic Book Lettering by Nate Picos. Like I said, I reviewed it. I actually learned a couple new things I've been using in my work, and I've been teaching to my students with it. I think with just this, you'll be fine. There's also blogs out there, like Jim Campbell's lettering blog, things like that. There's plenty of material if you want to find it. And also, if I can plug my own stuff,
please do.
Besides teaching the first years at the Hubert School, every couple months, I'd say every season, you know, fall, spring, summer, winter, we do an online class for 6 weeks that anybody can take. You know, so if you just want to do just lettering, you can sign up for my class. I don't know when the next one's going to be up. I haven't announced it yet. But, you know, if you do want to learn from me, you can absolutely take that class. And it's very informal. It's just, you know, I go over basics. I give you a couple sample pages. And then we do one project and just kind of like figure out how to letter pages.
Well, everyone, that book, the Nate Picos book, will be in our recommended reading, which you can find at geekhistorylesson.com/recommended reading, along with a couple of books that Taylor has also worked on. And Taylor, that's perfect. That you, first off, thank you so much for giving us all this amazing knowledge. I know I learned a lot, and I think we even barely scratched the surface.
Oh, I could talk for hours as my students, yeah, unfortunately.
So I will say to listeners, if you really enjoyed this episode, we can easily bring Taylor back and go even deeper into comic book lettering. We could even, I would say, if Taylor was amicable to the whole idea, we could pick a couple of like maybe old classic comic books and sort of like look at them specifically and like what they did right, what he thinks they did wrong. We could evaluate. This is such an amazing opportunity because Taylor is a teacher. We are a mind university. Taylor, if they want to catch that class and all your other future projects, please tell our listeners where they can find you online.
So you can find me on Twitter at Taylor Espo. And if you just want to follow the books, you can follow at Ghost Glyph. That you can do Twitter and Instagram. Facebook, you can do Ghost Glyph Studios. If you want to find out stuff from the school directly, go to their Twitter. I think it's the Hubert School, at the Hubert School. They'll always announce the classes. I'll always retweet them. So when the classes are up, you will find them, absolutely. My Twitter can get a little blue, so if that's not something you want to follow, please don't.
And also, as we said, there is so many posts about Jason Todd.
There are a lot of posts
about Jason Todd. There's a lot of posts about Jason Todd.
And Titan came back, and Red Hood's in it. And I just watched episode 4 last night.
Don't spoil it.
No spoilers, but I mean, it's awesome.
I also said Jason Pod, and I want to apologize that to the listeners. Taylor, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much. Everybody, if you love Taylor, we're going to have more with Taylor on Patreon over at patreon.com/Jawin. That's J-A-W-I-I-N. That is the Patreon where you can support the podcast and you also get extra podcasts. So Taylor will be on an episode of Geek History Lesson Extra. We'll be talking about some contemporary comic books, some contemporary lettering that he's really digging, some stuff that he's loving. We're going to dig more into Taylor. And also we have our Justice League Review podcast and all kinds of other podcasts to support the show. And we thank all our patrons that do that. So go over there, be a super friend. Even $1 support makes a huge difference in keeping this podcast alive and going. So check that out at patreon.com/Jawin. Don't forget, everybody, to follow the podcast on social media at GHL Podcast on Twitter and facebook.com/Geek History Lesson on Facebook. I myself also have an Instagram and Twitter, and that is at Jawin. There's a theme here, at Jawin. That's J-A-W-I-I-N. Go check me out over there. I've been sharing a lot of, I just shared actually on my Instagram, a cameo of Jupiter Jett where Mr. Taylor Esposito is in the picture where we put the entire creative crew in a jail cell in Jupiter Jett Volume 1. So if you want to go see what Mr. Taylor Esposito looks like, go check that out. Finally, to end our episode, hashtag stick around is the end of the podcast where we always make sure that our listeners stick through our plugs. And Taylor, I want you to tell them a story about working on one of our projects. This could be Jupiter Jett, Science, Super Best Friend, Aurora, because a lot of these listeners are huge supporters of our comic book Kickstarters. And is there an interesting story from any of our projects that you can think about? Or are we just boring? We're pretty boring.
No. With Super Best Friend, I remember when we were getting started and you're giving me like the elevator pitch and everything, you're like really leaning into like that Silver Age, Jimmy Olsen stuff. And you're like, this is what we want to do with it. Ah, how am I going to get this across? Like, cause it's a very particular style. So, you know, you had all this reference and I was like looking at this, like, how do we make this like really like bombastic, like fun stuff? And it was just like pouring over old Jimmy Olsen and old Superman. And just trying to get that voice right. And that was just, it was a good challenge. It was a lot of fun.
That's interesting that you know, you added a lot because you put, there are certain times in the Super Best Friend scripts where I'll have to basically say Silver Age it up, Taylor, or I'll be like the Silver Age style. And I just assume that you know what I'm talking about. Or I'm like, do the Silver Age thing.
If I don't know what you're talking about, I'll either do one of two things. I'll look it up or I'll just like, show me what you want, man. I'll do it.
Yeah. Most of the time I will say in comic book scripts, I tend to try to dummy proof it where I'm just like, I don't want Taylor have to spend, he's a busy man. I don't want him to spend 15 minutes Googling something. Here it is. Just to save the time. It'll save the stress for everybody. And that way we won't have an email thread of like, what are you talking about? But that's great.
All my favorite writers do that.
Well, there you go. Taylor, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Geek History Lesson. This was fantastic, my friend.
Thank you for having me. It was so much fun.
And thank you to everybody listening. I really appreciate you listening to this episode. We had a great time. Thank you for listening to Geek History Lesson. I am Jason Watch the Bleed Inman, and your class is now dismissed.